You're listening to the Deceptionist Podcast. Today, world building, geography, and history.
I have dreamt of a place and time where nobody gets annoyed. But I must admit, I'm not there yet, but something's keeping me going. Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Maybe there's a world that I'm still
to find. You're listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction, a roughly fortnightly podcast all about the craft of storytelling. We're by storytellers for storytellers, looking to bring a sense of community to the solitary pursuit of writing. I am Jim Ruchkowski. Sitting miles and miles away from me are Kelly Stevenson.
Hello.
Carolyn Pruitt.
Hello.
And Mr. Dave Acampo.
Hey there.
Hey there. Tonight, or today, I'm not going to tell you when to listen, we are re-examining the topic of world building on our kind of multi-episode arc. Today we get to the subject of crafting the history and geography of the world that you are building. Each of us, as you may remember from previous episodes, and if you don't, please download them. We are all assigned a certain type of story, and as such, assigned a type of world that we have to build. Today, we're going to sit and discuss some of the challenges that we have faced with the subject of history and geography. Dave, I'm going to suspect that you're chomping at the bit to talk about your experience, but I may be wrong. Before we started, I should let the listener in on some things. We spent about 10 minutes just shooting the breeze like we always do, and I think it was Kelly who said, can we agree or did we all discover that geography is useless?
I think that was the phrase, yes.
Strong, controversial words.
Yes. I'm going to get letters from geography teachers across the globe.
Oh, real world geography, I agree with you, but that's a different show.
Well, so I'm kind of glad you're throwing it to me first because to remind listeners, my topic or my chosen prompt was a fantasy world. And fantasy worlds are classically what begin with a map in the beginning of the book, right? So I should be all about the geography for this. But as people may remember from the last time, is that I've always been sort of, as we've entered into this whole world building discussion, I've always been sort of like, well, I don't know. I need to have the characters do something to make it make sense. And so to that point, geography hasn't played a large role in what I've written thus far. I read last time, and it was really like this kingdom in the north. I mean, basically, I established what I needed to establish as it came up writing. There was a king and a girl, and she was from the desert to the south, and he was from the mountains in the north. And to me, that's sort of the beauty of fantasy, is that I'm sort of taking elements, and in fact, I was taking very basic elements from my real life and then just sort of boiling them down into a crucible that, you know, doesn't have to be what is the Northland means. It doesn't necessarily mean Northern California or anything. The map right now just is sort of mountains in the north and desert in the south, and that's about as far as it goes. So I'm not building out some Tolkien-esque map as I go. I'm sort of going like, well, and in the desert lands, there were some people to the east that were pushing forward to invade them for some reason. I'll figure that out when it is important to do so.
One cube-shaped continent, right, surrounded on all sides by voluminous water.
And so I guess that's where I'm running into, I don't know if it's the struggle I'm running into. I raised a question to you guys, and I don't want to deviate too far away from geography and history, which are our topics today, but when you're making up a world from scratch and I'm sort of just using the characters to illuminate the world for me, like what do I need them to be? What are the sort of iconic elements that I need? Rather than like draw on real history, I found myself going, well, can I just make up the kind of trees? If I just say that there's a creature, what if I just say it's a snake mouse and it is what I want it to be. And it's not based on anything anthropological or historical or even mythical. It's just, you know, like my previous statement about people with giraffe necks, right? It's just something I want to have out there. So I guess my question maybe to you guys to help me along is, even though I'm writing fantasy, do you think that there is a level of either reference to myth or something that is anthropological or scientific that needs to make sense? Or if I just make up everything from the types of trees to the names of animals and I make them all up, which is kind of what I was having fun doing, does it sort of boil down into some sort of Dr. Seuss-like world that maybe throws people off, that I have trouble relating to people with? Do I have to have, I guess I look to stuff like the Game of Thrones stuff, where I think Caroline, who's better at me into this kind of stuff, you know, pointed to, oh, well, clearly George R. R. Martin is pulling from this point in history and he's sort of just extrapolating it into a fantasy thing. I can't do all that. So, but if I make up too much, I mean, is his stuff stronger because he bases it in sort of a strong point of view based in the real world and then just shifts it into a world with dragons and stuff like that?
I don't, because I've heard as many people with Martin, like, who like know the War of the Roses stuff, like, will complain bitterly about his interpretation of it and how he missed this and that and blah blah blah.
You mean they so say there are no dragons? There were no dragons.
Well, no, not just the dragons, but like, right. Okay, well, he says, and this is maybe getting more to sociology, but he has this certain set way that, like, that the women, for instance, are in that kingdom, you know, and they're, like, denied political power because they're women. Whereas if you actually look at the roles that the women played in that historical period, you would actually find that the historical women actually had a much larger role than they're granted in the fantasy, like that kind of thing.
This is where your average deceptionist pipes up with, that's why he made it fiction.
Well, you're right. But then I guess what Dave is saying is that, you know, does that actually lend a strength to the story for it to resemble reality, or is that more there for him to have a framework for him to work for?
Is there a line?
I'm sure that there are people who are like, oh wow, this is awesome because it's like, you know, whatever that happened in 1485. But
if I'm trying to write fantasy, is there a line I cannot cross? A line at which point my structure crumbles around me because I've made up too much?
I mean, I guess the advantage of using something that is maybe real and historical is that you're like, okay, this is something that worked. Like, if the siege of whatever in the Two Towers is kind of based on a historical siege, then you're like, okay, this gives me some place to go when I'm examining what siegecraft is like, you know, something like that. I think because you know, if you just have no idea how these things would relate, then, you know, having a historical framework gives you something to work with. But I think if you can make it internally consistent, if it's going to work for the reader, then that's okay.
Right. I guess what I worry about is if I'm basing my siegecraft on fantasy that I've read rather than history, am I sort of making a carbon copy of a carbon copy? Am I losing cohesion to that? Maybe another element that I'm worried about.
Well, on one level, you're protecting yourself from the ability, you're defending yourself against the claim that that would never happen, that's completely unrealistic.
In my world, it totally does.
I would direct you to Watergate, sir, or whatever it might be.
Right.
But yeah, it also, I think, robs you of the freedom that mm-hmm. is probably the whole point of writing fantasy.
Right, right. And that's, I think, if I'm being totally honest, it's a mix of I was enjoying the freedom and I'm lazy to do the research.
Right.
If I'm being totally honest, that's where I am right now, because I don't want to do – I want to just sort of play with the things that excited me as a kid. And I think that's what I'm sort of tapping into as I get into this fantasy world, is that even though I'm drawing on an older character because I wanted something, as I mentioned in the previous episode, you know, that was sort of different than the normal, like, hero's journey that we always see, I wanted to start with an older character, but I'm still tapping into the elements that excited me as a kid, which was this strange world where you've just got a sword and the trees might be coming after you, you know, or whatever right. It is. So, yeah.
Kelly, have you read fantasy?
You know, here and there.
Yeah.
I think as a writer, there's always that challenge of communicating what you see in your mind to the reader. And if you keep things grounded in context, whether that context is actual historical historical history, as opposed to the other kinds of history we have, or if it's other fantasy conventions, then it's easier to speak to your audience, and it's in a lot of ways easier for you as a writer. If you are making up an entirely new vocabulary, if you are writing a world that Dr. Seuss draws, that is a giant challenge, and to get it into your reader's mind with just words, I think it's not, I don't want to say it's too much of a challenge, but it's too much of a challenge.
Yeah, well, people have to have something to ground themselves with.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen David Lynch's Dune,
right?
But,
yes.
David Lynch can make a movie about suburban America that I find completely indecipherable. If you've ever seen particularly the director's cut of, you know, there's just no context whatsoever to, you know, this world is so outside my frame of reference, and these people are acting like all of this makes complete sense, and I have no idea what's going on, and they're not even using English necessarily. They're making up words about sandworms and things, and, you know, like, I think basing it on historical reality is a nice template. It hampers you somewhat, but it also gives you that context that the reader is literally an alien from another world seeing this world for the first time, and you have to make it at least accessible for them to interpret what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
Well, and then you're faced with a problem where, so you've created this whole new, you know, fantastical world where there are tiny miniature elephant creatures running around, and, you know, the trees, the leaves sprout up out of the ground and the roots are in the ceiling. Nobody in your world thinks that's odd. So they're not going to spend the time to be like, holy shit, that tree's upside down. They don't, it's not upside down to them. And so, again, there's that challenge of why would they even bother looking at it so that the reader can see it.
Right. And that's one of the things we talked about with the portal worlds, which is then you're bringing someone from our world into it, and then they get to go, holy shit, the trees are upside down or whatever, right? So
right.
I get that. I guess in my – so to put a little context to it, you guys remember what I wrote the first time. Jim may not, as he may have been asleep.
How dare you?
Someone had to say it sooner or later in this podcast. So I wrote about this old king who is about to be killed because he's, you know, it's about to be his birthday, and it's a certain point where there's this tradition where the king is always killed. And I had this idea that and this prologue sort of ended with him deciding, you know, what if he fought instead of just dying? So to sort of shift focus from that, I decided in the next little bit I would write would be about another character, and I'm writing about his second son, and he's a poet, and I kind of like that idea, and I sort of tapped into this vein where he's sort of like, he writes with a freedom that the second son can write, because the first son is going to become the king, so the second son gets to be whatever he wants to be, which is, you know, I thought, you know, is very personal to me, but I needed him to be, you know, writing poetry somewhere, so I made up this name of a tree in the previous prologue, and I decided that it would, they sort of, the branches went upwards like a snake, and that there was this crown at the top of it, and I thought that's where he would perch and write poetry. So he's sitting there, and I'm just saying as the narrator that he's sitting at the top, in the crown of this tree, and he's, you know, trying to think of words to describe love, which he's never really thinks he's felt, and he's observing the snake mice that are coiling around the branches and stuff, which is just something that I felt like was cool. You know, so I'm not going out of my way to say like, oh my god, these are weird things, but I am trying to set the stage in a way, but I'm using sort of really unique and so I guess this kind of ties to geography in that it's the plant life and the animal life of the area, but I'm not basing it on anything from where I grew up. I just wanted him to be sitting in a really cool kind of tree. And so that's where I'm running into these things, is like, if I start making up every tree and rock and animal, you know, where does that get me? And so I guess the other thing I think about is I haven't read a lot of long form fantasy that uses that, but I do recall, like, I don't know if you guys have ever read Italo Calvino or anything like that, who I've read some of his short stories that are fantasy, but they're not epic fantasy. They're sort of about two brothers who, you know, climb up to the moon to scoop up some I can't even remember the story now. Caroline, you usually know these things. You know who I'm talking. You know the story I'm talking about.
I don't know that story. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I saw a Pixar short that sounds.
I was
going to
say
like that
reminds me of the Pixar thing. On but it, whatever
it's like
the last movie
it's like one of those surrealist paintings I was talking about. It's just sort of like the it defies physics, but it's like this folk tale, and it's got its own logic to it, and it makes sense in and of itself. But it's not based on any existing folklore that I know of. It's just, you know, it's sort of like magic realism that Marquez or somebody might use in their writing. But, you know, it is kind of its own world in a way, because you can take a boat and get to the moon and then, you know, get some stuff off the moon, you know. I think they're like harvesting something off the moon. I can't remember.
That really is like the Pixar film.
Wow. It must be the same thing. Yeah, it's two brothers and a little kid, and they have to climb up to the moon to sweep the stars off because the stars keep getting hit on the moon.
It's a thing they ran in front of Brave. Right?
Yeah, it did.
That explains why you're all in an alternate universe I've never seen.
It's called, if anyone wants to look it up, it's called The Distance of the Moon. It's by Italo Calvino. And the characters have names like it's QFWFQ. So that gives you an idea of this sort of fantasy that this is. Yeah, and they take a boat and they have a ladder. And if you go out to sea where the moon is the lowest and you can take a ladder and put it in your boat and climb to the top, you can get up to the moon.
It is, in fact, that is, I just Googled it. It's what that is what the Pixar short
there
is
you
based
go.
On. So, okay. Excellent.
I like it. I like that Pixar is bringing it back. Uh-huh.
It's super adorable, by the way. And I blew Charlotte's mind because they're like swimming in the boat and she's like, where are they going? I'm like, I don't know, but I bet it's going to have something to do with the moon. And she's like, how did you know? Let me explain language to you.
That's cute.
Charlotte is Kelly Stevenson's daughter.
Sorry, yes, my 4.5-year-old.
Every podcast is somebody's first, Kelly.
My daughter.
You know those conversations when if people start talking like you already know what somebody's name is and you can't decide if it's their spouse, their child, or their dog, and you have to figure it out from context? Anyway, I got that from context, but I guess I did already know the name of your daughter. So, anyway. So Dave,
probably not my
son. So those are my struggles this month anyway.
You know, and it's interesting because I would have thought, since you're doing the kind of, you know, high fantasy, I would have automatically thought, oh, well, you need all the different places because you need places for them to go. And I guess, like I know, you know, with The Hobbit, you envision the map at the beginning, you know, just because of having seen it. But I also, like, that book is very much you go on a journey that has these different stages to it. It's very much tied to, okay, you have to get across the mountains, then you have to get through the woods, then you have to get to the mountain. And, you know, that's why the geography in that case matters, because those are the different phases of the story. So, I mean, I don't know how much your story is a quest sort of journey story. Mm-hmm. So it might be that you're going to sort of get your places as you go along. Like,
yes.
You're like, I you know, I know more, like, I know what point I need them to get to. And so, but I think, like, what you're talking about just kind of like noodling and sort of figuring out what comes into your head as far as what kind of things they're going to see. Mm-hmm. You know, use the imagination, like, sort of let that come out when you start with, and then you will probably find out that you have a use for whatever these, you know, special kind of trees or whatever in the story that you didn't realize when you first came up with it. Like, because now that you've made them up, they're there. And so those have become tools that are there for your characters.
Yeah, and in fact, to your point, and I just, this was a throwaway line, I have him, he hears this horn in the distance, and this is, you know, it's tying up with, you know, the fact that his father is he thinks that the horn sound is going to be his father's death, because that's, you know, usually what it symbolizes. But then then he hears a second one and he's like, oh wait, that means something else. And I'll mention that more when we get to the history part. But I have him like getting down the tree and I'm saying there's these like thorns in the tree, but he has been climbing this tree to go right and imagine things all his life so he can get around it. And I'm like, ah, now my character has a skill. So he's a little nimble and he can get around this stuff. That's going to come in handy later. And I'll save the rest of that thought for when we get to the history. But to your point, I am inventing things, and then I'm letting them sort of shape what's happening with my characters, and I'm letting it all happen. And I realized when you said that about The Hobbit, maybe the way I need to write, because I fell in love with and I loved epic fantasy when I was a kid. I mean, those were the first novels I remember reading, and they were always these journeys, right? That maybe I want to approach writing like that. Like, I don't want to have it all laid out in my head, because I need to go, where does he go now? Oh my God, mountains. There's mountains. And then I need to surprise myself. So I get all excited about it and try to figure out what would happen on this quest. But it definitely will be a quest component to this. But I just realized I was also having fun populating and going around the kingdom to different people. The second son, the first son, maybe some other characters will come up as I keep writing. I don't know.
I'm so close to having go ahead.
No.
My point is not good, believe me.
I predict that by the end of this journey that you are on as a writer, Dave, you will probably have a map.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Like, it makes sense. It makes sense that right now you're just, you know, north, south, east, mountains over here, desert down there. But yeah, by the time you get to the end of it, I bet you'll have a really strong map. And I think that's a luxury that since you're building a completely alien world, as long as you keep, you know, general rules of, I don't know, weather patterns and geography in your mind a little bit, that's something you can do. You can afford to wait, whereas say the rest of us who are building in worlds that already exist might need to do a little bit more planning in the beginning if we want any sort of journey element to our stories.
Yeah, that sounds like a good segue.
Indeed.
To someone else. Anyone, really.
Well, yes, I will say, just to put a cap on that, that I was close to having a good example for Dave, although none of the ones I'm coming up with really apply. I'm thinking of the Star Wars movies and also the original L. Frank Baum Oz books, all of which are in some way some kind of quest, and all of which take place in a completely fictional continent or galaxy, depending on, you know, what we're talking about, but I don't think anyone involved. Well, I know for a fact, no one involved sat down and said, "Here are all of the, you know, parts of the country that exist in Oz. Here are all the planets that exist in this galaxy." They just sort of had an idea of what they wanted the characters to go through, and then those parts of the world materialized to fit their needs. The maps were all drawn later.
Yeah, and that's what I was just going to say. I think, to Kelly's point, I will end with a map, but I'm not beginning with a map.
Yes. Yeah. Kelly strikes me as the beginning with a map kind of person. you could never write Star Wars.
One thing that Star Wars is that, like, maybe like a novel isn't necessarily, is that it's a serial. And I think even if George Lucas or whoever, when he starts the first Star Wars movie that he made, even if he had a map in his mind, it's probably good that he didn't put it all up in the first film.
Yes.
Because, you know, assuming that there are ideas in those films that continue to develop as they went on, then you kind of are stuck with what you do from the start. And if you're the kind of person who wants to be stuck with what you started with, that could be a good thing. But I think, like, you know, it might be your situation. Like, I mean, the first Star Wars is a self-contained movie.
Right.
Yes. You know, so then they come back and they add things as they go along to sort of broaden the universe. So you've done sort of both things at the same time. So I think it really depends on how big of chunks you're seeing your story in,
right?
And, you know, how much do you want to? So I think there's two different questions of how much you plan and then how much you share up front. And like Dave, for instance, like when you were doing Wormwood, mm-hmm. I would imagine if you had in the first episode said, there are five kinds of monsters that exist and we're going to fight all of them, this is all that they are. And then you're like, after episode five, you're like, shit, what do we do? Right?
Right, exactly.
So and then you will also run into the things where you're like, oh my god, I can't believe now they're saying they're fairies when they already said there are no fairies, you know that. So that's right. Definitely a. So I mean, I think there's two. Like, don't limit yourself too much up front, especially if you know that as a writer you are going to keep running into things and saying, oh, that's a good idea, I want to do something more with that.
Right, right.
Like, definitely sort of leave some open end.
Well, and that's actually what I've been sort of dealing with in terms of history for my story, she says in another segue.
I heard that you were so well done.
Thank you. It doesn't really work when I go like, by the way, that was an awesome segue. But yeah, I don't know if we want to keep talking about geography, but if we want to switch a little bit to history, I have a thing that I wrote.
Everything I have to say about geography is that my story is based on the planet Earth in the United States of America, so I don't really have a lot of wiggle room per se. The end.
I don't know. There could be like, you know, global warming because
there could be. Yes. Yes. Oh, believe me. Yes.
But yes. But Jim, to your point, now remind everyone, you had a Big Bird dies and the whole world changes story, right? But
yes.
I mean, are nations changing? I mean, is there, I mean, not geographical, like physical geography, but are we, you know,
are the borders moving, basically?
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of. More the direction I took it in was basically that, for anyone who's listening to all of this for the first time, I was doing a alternate history. I had read somewhere around the time we were given these assignments that NASA was looking to send a civilian up into space. They eventually settled on schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe, but for a lengthy period of time, they were planning to send Big Bird up into space on the Space Shuttle Challenger, which obviously did not end very well for anyone involved. And I've been thinking a lot since then about the alternate history that would have resulted and the and how that history would affect the geography. I didn't think in terms of like all of the children of the world were sad and China was able to take over America. But it was more like, you know, because that happened, an entire generation of people grew up much more cynical and despairing than they used to. And a lot of funding was cut to NASA. And so global warming was, you know, twice as bad as it has been. And so, you know, a lot of the things that we predict are going to happen have happened already in my world. And so the coasts have moved and the ice caps have moved and things like that. So
your geography,
you have quite
has
a bit
shifted.
Of geography.
Yeah.
So just because I felt like I had to be completely honest. But, you know, I read actually just today about a book by Philip Roth that I'd never heard of before called The Plot Against America. And it was a book that he had written for quite a random reason. He basically speculated what would have happened if Charles Lindbergh had run for office in 1940 and had defeated FDR, because that was something a lot of American isolationists were in favor of at the time. And if he had run, he was very, you know, boyish, and he was a celebrity, and he was the vision of manliness, and he was a big isolationist, and he was a huge anti-Semite. And so he envisioned this whole radically different world where the president of the United States signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler in the 1940s and everything, you know. And it was just Charles Lindbergh, I think of as like, I don't know, kind of the equivalent of Lance Armstrong or something. And it was just fascinating to me how, to Philip Roth, pulling this one thread that didn't seem to have anything to do with the tapestry at all, like it was a fringe outlier at best, ended up changing the whole course of the world. And I sort of felt like there was a kind of similar thing going on with my story because, like,
absolutely, yeah.
What the hell is Big Bird? But,
right.
You know, like if Big Bird had died in 1986, everyone who had ever watched Sesame Street, everyone who was a kid at the time, you know, would have been profoundly affected, and none of it positive. And that has a ripple effect. And so, you know, you don't imagine basically the effect that it would have on geography is entirely dependent on how much control you think human beings have over the climate, essentially, or, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. So that was supposed to be a one sentence brush off. So good luck with
that.
But
that's really good. That's your struggle that you're going through is how yes. much can this big bird change, you know, the world.
That's right.
You know, I mean, because we're talking about nation borders could shift. You're talking about actual physical geography could shift. So you're actually letting your imagination play out. And, you know, the world is shifting a little bit. And so you get to explore that as you go along.
But I'm no Dave Ocampo in that I have borders and boundaries and strictures that, you know, I can't just put a cube in an ocean.
Right, right.
And, you know, I've got to deal with China.
Damn, so, ocean. I'm going to have to invent an ocean at some point.
That's right. Now, Kelly, on the other hand, has a whole different situation going on.
Well, I haven't spent too much time with geography because I haven't actually gotten to the point in my story where I know exactly how the events that lead up to the world as it is in my story got there. I know there's a lot of
useless.
What?
You were the one who said it was useless.
Yeah, I did. Yes. And I didn't mean all the way useless. And yes, to your earlier dig about me and my maps, when I'm plotting an epic fantasy that has a journey, I need to know where they're going. And I also, you know, I've written other stories, or I've not written, but plotted other worlds where, you know, it's like a school for wizards that's in the middle of the country. Well, I need to know exactly where in the middle of the country it is, that sort of thing. But for this story specifically, my bigger thing is history. And to back to earlier, we were talking about what you discover along the way and what you start with. I decided that the major plot of this story would actually be someone discovering the truth. So I've created several, I guess maybe just two different sort of versions of the history. One that is the truth that nobody knows about yet, so I'm not really worrying about that. Well, not nobody knows about it, but it's been covered up. So none of the characters in my story at this point know what that is. And then the fake history that people have put on top of it.
So you're kind of building a big mystery then.
Yes, that's I decided really that would be interesting.
That's very cool.
And I haven't actually figured out who my main character is yet. I can't decide whether it's... Well, there's women in my story at this point. I can't decide which one of them is the main character. But I would like to read you a little bit because one of my biggest struggles as a writer is I feel like I can create these worlds and everything, but getting them out in a form that communicates it to my reader without it sounding like a lecture to my reader. You know, like I could sit and explain it to you all day, but having characters sort of organically explain the world to you through context is a real challenge of mine.
It's very odd that you would say that. That Philip Roth book I was just talking about, where Lindbergh is the president. I was reading an essay by Philip Roth about why he wrote that book and how he wrote that book, and he made a special point to mention that it's so hard not to be didactic when you're talking to the audience because they know the world up to 1940, but after that they have no idea what you're talking about. So like if you talk about Yalta, they understand, but if you talk about like Iceland understanding or whatever, like some fictional event, you have to drop it in conversation like it's nothing, while at the same time educating them about this event that they have never heard of because it didn't happen.
Right.
Yes.
So hopefully I did a little bit of that in this bit that I'm going to read to you now. I think to give our previous listeners and Jim context.
I don't want to live down. I don't want to. I want to own it. I want it to be my thing.
Good. This straw that I drew was a story set in our future, in the far future in this planet, which is kind of ironic because it was my least favorite thing. But I'm digging it. I think last time we talked, I described that the situation was a world where there were three or four genders instead of two.
Right.
I'd settled whether there were three or four. At this point, there are most definitely three. And, you know, I kind of wanted to explore family dynamics and gender issues and gender equality issues. And I really was struggling at that point to figure out how everyone is equal. And what I want to explore in the story is, what does the world look like when people have always sort of felt this way, that it's not a new thing that people fought for? And that's kind of where this sort of hidden history comes in. Everyone at this point thinks it's the way life has always been. And somebody will eventually discover that is not the way it has always been, and how that changes things, or if it does at all. I'd like to think it doesn't at all, but I don't know yet. This is the story. At this point, the working title of the whole thing is called The Vessel, which makes sense in a minute. So here I go. Does it hurt? I looked down at the shock of brown curls resting her head against my knee. She'd asked so gently while concentrating on not looking at me. I knew this was a very important question. Does what hurt, love? I feigned ignorance as I gently stroked her hair. I placed the other hand on the swell of my stomach. The tiny life inside squirmed as if it couldn't wait to come out and play with its sister. The bonds between siblings were always strongest when they shared all three parents. Being a vessel, she responded. She shifted her position so she could place her hand over mine. She still wouldn't look at me. Mama Jay says she's happy to be an egg, because being a vessel is hard work and it hurts. I frowned. I knew Lucy was twisting something innocent Jan had said, but it was still disappointing. Jan knew better and should have watched her words. Lucy looked up at me, blue eyes searching mine for the truth behind whatever I was about to say. It is, and it does, I confessed, but not all the time. Is it hard work? Harder than being an egg, I mean? More frowning, I was grateful she had looked away again. It's just different. How? What have they taught you at school? A calculated dodge. I knew she was less than a few months from her own transition, and one of her friends had already crossed over. I don't know why I wasn't ready for these questions from her, but I wasn't. She sighed, on to my game. God created man and woman, but when she saw that the burden of motherhood was too great for one alone, she bade Eve eat from the tree of life so that she would bear another woman, free of Adam's seed. Eve became the egg and Lilith the vessel, and together they, with Adam the seed, they became the parents of all people. Not in scripture class. What do they tell you in science about the difference between eggs and vessels? That when we reach a certain age, our bodies change and we become either eggs or vessels. Eggs and seeds make babies together, but only vessels can grow them and feed them with their bodies. That's right. She finally rewarded me with a smile. Growing babies in my belly is hard work. Giving birth hurts, but it's only for a little while. And for the most part, there's no difference between being an egg or a vessel or a seed. We're all just people in our family. Do you mind that I don't look like you? You're made of me, love. I wouldn't have it any other way. I kissed her forehead. And as far as anyone's concerned, that counts as much as having Mama J's hair or Papa D's crooked little finger. Footsteps echoed in the hall as Jan approached. What's this I hear about my hair? She asked. Lucy started to explain, but I jumped ahead of her. Lucy was asking if being a vessel hurt. Oh. And whether it was harder work than being an egg. Oh. My wife had the good sense to look sheepish as she crossed the carpet to where we were sitting. She avoided my gaze as she sat next to Lucy. Is this about that talk we had last night, sweetie? Lucy nodded. We were talking about Marcia and how she was picking on one of the other girls who just found out she was an egg, right? Yes, Sally found out last night that she's an egg. Jan turned to me. Apparently, Marcia's developed quite an attitude since she learned she was a vessel. So you told Luce that being a vessel wasn't all sunshine and roses? I asked, connecting the dots. More or less, she admitted. I may have gone too far. I flinched as our newest family member delivered a particularly strong kick to a nerve in my back. Jan saw and raised an eyebrow. Or maybe not, she said with a laugh as she placed her hand on my stomach. Is he giving you much trouble today? The end. Not really the end, but that's what I said.
Clap.
That's excellent.
Yikes. And you've got the child in there as the sort of the newcomer, because I think you almost need to do that because of what you were saying about how the characters in this think this is the way it's always been.
Right.
So that's almost like the only way you have of explaining it to somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, that definitely, if you're going to tell it in a first person narrative, which is very difficult to do.
Like Caroline was saying, I needed someone who cared. I needed someone who needed to have it explained more or less. So that's where Lucy came from, because I figured if she was nervous about it, then we could explain the differences to her and blah, blah, whatever. But I didn't want it to be like the sex ed class.
But that was a masterful way of doing that, because, I mean, to Jim's point, you know, about the Philip Roth example, I mean, that is a real conversation that parents and children have, right? So you found a way to deliver this information but still make it feel real and authentic while strange and different, which is very cool. I really, really appreciated that. That was great.
Well, and I went – thank you very much. And I went into first person with – does she even have a name yet? She doesn't have a name. Her name is Emma. That's right. But she doesn't have a name in it. So I went with her in first person, partially because I thought she was the main character. I know that we talked last time, and I was thinking that it would be cool if like someone was a matchmaker in this world where you have to pair three, well, not pair, whatever you do when you put three people together, and how interesting that would be. So I was gonna make her the matchmaker, and so like basically after she sends the girl off to school, she then basically fires up her computer and starts doing her matchmaking stuff. And I wanted to make it first person so that she could have some sort of internal monologue that got some of the more sciencey things together. And you could see what it felt like to be in a relationship with two other people that you couldn't really get if there were three. If it was third person.
Mm-hmm.
But then just creating this, just this one scene, like Lucy sort of popped in my head, and I think Lucy might be the main character. So that we can totally capture that experience of the transition from a transitioner's perspective. And then she goes on her own little quest herself.
You could do it as an ensemble. I mean, would it benefit you from having multiple sort of main characters where this mystery unravels?
Like every chapter was a different first person narrative?
Yeah. Pulling a George. Which is pretty much how I try to write everything, because I want it to be from one person. I want it to be from everyone's first person perspective. But yeah, I haven't gotten that far yet. But I do. I dig the people.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's funny though, because the minute I said, I think it was last week, where I was like, I will be responsible and I will share, and then that will convince me, that will encourage me to motivate myself to write, other stories started bubbling in my head, and they were like, write me. And I'm like, no, it's not time for the epic other world art alternate reality fantasy. It's time for future story. And they're like, no, that's too bad. Which was really frustrating.
Yeah, no, I think that happens to all of us. I definitely have had a little bit of that. Your mind works that way. But now we're talking about history. So how much history did you have? You just said you came up with almost like two parallel histories, the real one and the sort of PR version. How much work went into that just to get to this, what you wrote?
I haven't actually, it's mostly all in my head right now, so I want to say no work at all, just because I don't have gobs and gobs of stuff written down. But I, you know, I know some things. I know that it's a sort of a blend of chemical warfare that almost wipes out the planet. I know how they get to the point where they need, basically they reach a point in human history where, because of a bunch of chemical warfare, absolutely nobody is able to reproduce without using technology.
Aha, uh-huh, okay. So
then we all, as a society, sort of panic, and we really up our game when it comes to being able, like, test tube babies, basically. Because otherwise the whole race will die out if we don't figure it out. So you literally can, when you decide you want to go, when you want to make a baby, you can go to Walmart and just make one. Maybe not Walmart, Walgreens. But it's important to me.
Someplace with the pharmacy.
If it's a super Walmart.
Which don't exist in my world, because it's my world, damn it. But then I thought about, you know, so that basically solved the science part of it, which is, you know, kind of part of the history. But then I wanted to get to everyone thinks that this is totally cool. And this is sort of more or less the way it's always been. And so just looking at current events and how, I don't want to get too far onto a soapbox, but how so many people seem to be hung up on specific Bible verses to justify dumb things.
No.
For example.
Those messages can go to... and no.
The geography teachers and all of the fun...
Right, books. Yes.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure... Well, we might have a lot of geography teachers listening to us.
So I realized that I needed scripture on my side.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Because if anyone could be like, dude, right there, 2.1, it's...
So, I mean, are they using the actual Bible that we use? Or is this... they could have their own scriptures?
So see, that's where the plot came in. Because I don't get to make up my own Bible, right?
Right.
Because this is this world.
Uh-huh.
Y'all are bastards. My thought... cheat and say that somebody at some point basically changed it, that there was this big revisionist history thing.
Well, there could just be a book added on. I mean, there's people do that. Joseph Smith.
You know, lost whatever, but it's buried enough in the past that everyone thinks that this is the way the Bible has always been written. And it's probably not going to be the Bible because I'm going to throw all my beliefs about religion in here too. But yeah,
kind of your book. Do what you want.
But so I'm cheating as much as I can.
I have a follow-up question.
Yes.
Does Noah issue 3 of every animal onto the ark?
Oh, I like that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, wait, do animals have to do this too?
Oh, shit.
I didn't mean to do that.
You
oh,
just
gosh.
Unraveled Kelly's whole...
Yeah, all right.
Well, it's fine. Only humans get to be in threes. Everyone else is stuck with twos.
That's how we know they're inferior to humans.
Right.
Yeah, there would have to be. Yeah, it's interesting. There'd have to be. People, you know, people get hung up on stuff like the gay penguins.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm talking about. Like that there
yes,
the fact
I do.
That, like those penguins in the zoo that like were male and that they made it, and this becomes a big thing because people especially want to like present to children, well, this is the way nature works. So, you know, that kind of that would come into it, assuming that there are animals and, you know, everybody's not eating just food replicators or whatever.
Right. The main takeaway from all of this is that Kelly's story is the best because we're all thinking about it more than we're thinking about our own.
Exactly right.
I'm intrigued.
Cool. I like it. I like writing things that are interesting to people. Yeah, but anyway, so that's – to kind of keep it, I wanted it to be – I wanted my own history, but I wanted to stick to the assignment where I'm making it based on our history too. So I couldn't just decide that scripture was different. And really, if the whole point is we went through this transition period in our history before my story starts, you know, our current scriptures are still an aspect. So this was kind of a workaround to get over the fact that our current scripture doesn't say there's 3 people.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yes.
I know we kind of skip past geography, but is your story on Earth?
Yes.
So it's just like there's not like no people aren't living on space stations or Mars colonies or whatever. It's Earth.
I don't want to get into that.
No, I mean, I don't blame you. I just wanted to make sure. I think I kind of went to space station when you're talking about future. So it took me a while to figure out that it was Earth. So that's just my issue.
Exactly where they are. I think I would like it to stay on the planet just because I have so many other things that I really care about talking about that I don't want to spend time explaining intergalactic travel, which is actually one of the bigger challenges that I'm going to be facing with this story is I need it to be set far enough in the future that some of this stuff is taken for granted, right? That nobody's grandmother remembers back when there were two mm-hmm. genders.
Well, I would argue that in your world, the reason that there is no interstellar travel or space colonies is because after Big Bird died, the whole interest in the space program was completely eliminated.
Oh, so these are the same universe. Kelly's trying to get the future of Jim's universe.
That's my argument.
Argue that we don't have a major population issue, we don't feel the need to get the fuck off the planet.
That's right. Exactly.
Things to worry about. But this is a problem that I have as this sort of completionist person that I am, where I have to know how every blade of grass evolved to be every blade of grass. If I set this 500 years in the future, like I'm a tech geek enough to understand how far we've come in the last 20 years with technology to be able to speculate where we're going to be 500 years from now if we haven't blown ourselves to bits is challenging. Like I don't want to dismiss the fact. I don't want to, you know, take the easy out and be like, oh, it's 500 years in the future, but you know, don't worry about it. We just have sliding doors and everyone wears slippers and we're cool. Like I feel the need to do some exploration on that front.
Given so that you have like a conspiracy thing in there, do you also have to figure out what's happened with the government, or is this a U.S. government? Do you even know 500 years in the future?
I know that it is. I know that that is a global conspiracy.
Okay.
Because if it doesn't happen in the whole world the whole time, if, you know, the population of the U.S. dips or the population of China dips, the rest of the world would be like, well, screw you guys. We're just going to make more of them.
Right.
Right.
Just for Chinese people. Make a letter for that too, aren't I?
If there were tribes in Burma where there were just men and women, it would wreck the whole ball game.
If there was one culture that needed test tubes to reproduce, they just wouldn't reproduce as much as everyone else. So it has to be a global thing.
Mm-hmm. But do the same governments exist though, or did something? I mean, if there's no shift because everyone went through the same thing, are maybe you don't know yet.
I don't really know yet.
Yeah. You will.
It's a global conspiracy, so at some point there must be a global government. Like, right?
Right, right.
One country can't decide, no, we're going to tell the truth. And I also pretty much need to figure out why it's so important.
Unless you make it the Illuminati, because they're behind everything.
Right. Did we talk about Fatherland the last time we were on this topic?
I think that that's one of the ones that came up in the history podcast that got erased. So I think you could mention it again. Yes.
Robert Harris of Silence of the Lambs fame wrote a book.
No, different that. Harris, but go ahead.
What?
Yeah.
Everything I knew was wrong. I have an alternate history.
Alternate
now.
History.
This person, Robert Harris, wrote a book called Fatherland. It was set in a world where Nazi Germany made a peace treaty with the West and successfully conquered Russia. So Hitler lived to a ripe old age, and through propaganda, he was like this beloved Ronald Reagan figure. And it starts out as a murder mystery where the Berlin police chief eventually uncovers the fact that there was a Holocaust, which has been covered up ever since the 1940s, and nobody in the world knows that it exists. And, you know, it's... It's one of those things where, like we were just talking about, you know, there is a real history there, or there is but it's so buried and so secret that it almost, you know, it everything that we take for granted is amazing in that world. I have stunned everyone into silence. This is my chance to take over.
No, we just all fell asleep, Jim.
Oh, no!
Oh, burn.
The hunter has become the hunted. This is my chance. Everyone, we're doing a whole new thing for Deceptionists. The others are asleep. We're all going to talk about how to write Tiger Beat articles from now on.
I don't think that's still a thing.
Talk about who is dreamy.
Sure, there.
Yeah.
No. Okay, exist. You know, I was just sort of explaining when Jim was talking about possibly not being available for tonight's podcast.
It's been a bad day. I was not sleepy. It was just a bad day.
Not, he was sleepy. I was having lunch with dinner with my extended family, excuse me, and was sort of explaining, like, because Charlotte saw my my text to Jim about the fact that he wasn't going to be there. And so she's like, why did you say no? Why did you say he has to be there? So then I had to explain to the whole table what was happening and explaining alternate histories. And before I led into, and Jim's cool alternate history is Big Bird, I cited, not remembering the name of the book, but like, for example, what if Hitler won World War II? What would the world look like? And everyone was like, oh, I get it. And then I struggled to come up with another example. Because it was like, once you've really said, what if Hitler won World War II, like, there are no more examples.
Well, there's an excellent faux documentary on Netflix Instant called CSA, The Confederate States of America, that I would highly recommend to anyone who's looking into this topic a little bit further. It's like a Ken Burns Civil War documentary if everything had turned out differently. Okay, everybody, they're asleep again. This is my chance.
I didn't think you were done with that thought.
But no, like, there are there's alternate histories are a whole genre of, you know, they used to have their own shelf in Borders or Walden Books or whatever dead bookstore there is. Like, there was a whole series about what would have happened if aliens had chosen to invade in the middle of World War II and Hitler and Stalin and Roosevelt had to make friends and, you know, like...
Is that alternate history or is that sci-fi?
Right, well, six of one, half a dozen of the other. But
maybe that guy knows something we don't know.
That's right. But I mean, there are books about what would have happened if Robert Kennedy had not been assassinated. There are books about what would have happened if the Beatles had broken up in 1966 because of the more popular than Jesus thing, which would have ended with John Lennon. I this is all part of something I just read the other day, by the way, about John Lennon assassinating Ronald Reagan in 1985.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, as far as you can go in any direction, somebody has probably gone there.
Right. Well, until Big Bird. I mean, that's, you know, that's right. you found the one.
I seriously cannot believe I'm the first person to plant my foot in this fertile soil. And I'm going to do nothing with it at all. No, that's slightly facetious, but anyway.
Well, you know, I think since we're talking about alternate histories and futures, this might be a good time to segue briefly to listener homework. So one of our listeners, CKL, I think his name is Chris Lewis, if I'm not mistaken, sent us some homework. I think he sent us two things. I'm not quite sure, but I have part two here in front of me. And he, we won't go through the whole thing because this is, I think Kelly would just love this document. I feel like, this is basically, he is going about, he said, as a reminder, my challenge was to create an alternate future. I went down the route of deciding on a world where antibiotics didn't work against highly resistant bacteria, where bacterial illness was seriously fatal. He then goes on to have a sort of spreadsheet that starts 3.8 billion years ago.
I approve.
So Chris goes all the way back, it's pretty intense because then he has this large cast, and if I'm reading this right, right about the time of 1958, he starts introducing these characters and when they're born. This is an insane document, but I'm very impressed because I just look at this and go, okay, so his alternate history is all of it.
Right.
It starts at the beginning of life and basically says, but it's pretty fascinating because he goes on to say, you know, that like the population wouldn't increase the way it did because people would be dying. And even in the present, the oldest person is 58 years old. That's the oldest living woman. Most people die around 50. And so how does that change and shape the world? And so it looks like he's having a lot of fun with this. It doesn't seem like he's... reading through it, I don't quite see exactly the story yet. it's a lot of background. But that may just be this document that I'm looking at too. But
he's building the map first.
He is. He definitely is. So that's very impressive. I give him 2 gold stars, maybe 3. 3 gold stars for your homework this month on The Deceptionist.
Speaking of this month on The Deceptionist, what is next? We've talked about history. We've talked about geography.
I want to briefly call out Caroline and just see if she has anything that she wants to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. We never talked to one-fourth of our team.
Caroline has mentioned that she had a difficult month. Has this conversation spawned anything for any of your imaginings, Caroline?
I was bad when I was with girls' school in military. So I was actually still, because I had actually been focused on this because I had pretty much thought that if we're going to do a world that is essentially two outsiders looks like ours, and then there's something going on at the school that other people don't know about. So you're not really changing the world very much. So in that kind of story, you're basically, what you're designing the history and geography of is the very specific setting, which in this case would be the school.
Right.
So, and I just have not really done it. But I mean, I think it'd be interesting to really kind of do, to I mean, you don't, obviously, you don't need to do Hogwarts necessarily, but it's like that kind of thing. You think about, you know, that's a very important location where, and J.K. Rowling, I don't think, I'm pretty sure, never gives you a map of Hogwarts. And you, so you actually kind of, and I think it may even be a joke, if you guys remember, they have the Room of Requirements, which is the room that sort of shows up when you need it, and it's exactly what you need. I don't know if to some extent that's actually something that was done as meta, but it's kind of a nice idea to have in mind when you're creating a setting like that, to sort of, you know, spread it out enough and give an idea of the sort of, I guess, the four corners of your map. And then what things do you need, and then what things are you going to add as you figure out. So, you know, like I keep coming up with stuff like, okay, you need to come up with a place that people can be alone. And it's kind of a thing that you see in various, like, you know, TV shows or film, but by particularly TV shows, if you have a set setting, you will kind of get the scenes where they have the specific places where they will go to talk. And the place is not important necessarily. Like a lot of times, you have the hospital shows, they'll go up and smoke on the roof. I've never, you know, gone up and hung out on the roof of a building on a regular basis. That may be something people in cities do more often. But it kind of works for storytelling because, at sort of, that's a, and particularly, like, imagine you have a school, they're going to theoretically be supervised all the time. So, you know, what are the places that you go that you are supervised, like that kind of thing. And, so, you know, which places are forbidden? Like, I imagine if your point of view character coming in is going to be a new student, most likely, they're going to tell her about certain places. And this isn't, I mean, this is an experience that anybody's going to have who's just even, you know, started a school or been to a new office. Somebody's going to give you the guided tour, but there's going to be things they don't tell you in the guided tour, and not necessarily out of sinister motives, just because, you know, there's things that you have to kind of discover for yourself. So I think that that's kind of, I think the idea in coming up with some kind of plan for a smaller, more contained setting like that would be, okay, what's the, you really need a few things about the visible introduction, and then what are the hidden things that are going to be discovered as the story goes along, rather than, you know, describing the map on the first page.
How do you think that you, as a writer, like, when you're thinking, when you thought of, oh, I need some place where they can go to be alone, were you imagining the scene first, going like, oh, I need to, I imagine a scene where they're talking about this. They need to be alone. I need to come up with it. Mm-hmm. Or are you thinking, going like, what are the things I'm going to need in this story? And you're thinking of just the things. And then that's spurring you to think about what scene might take place in that location.
I definitely, I mean, things I've written where I created a location, it's very much, okay, this is the action that needs to happen. Okay, what's the place that it should occur? And so I do usually end up building outwards from that. But,
right,
you know,
right.
Again, you start with, I think, sort of a basic idea of where things are. And I, for me, that usually tends to be a second draft issue, as far as I know just the very basics of where I'm locating my characters who are having this, you know, whatever conflict or conversation, and then the rest of it I have to kind of build up around, and usually kind of overwrite the second time, and then kind of rein it in again the third
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I obviously have no specific ideas, but I think that it's sort of worth talking about the fact that, you know, your geography and your history don't have to be on a global, as far as, like, you know, the history of a school, you always have that scene where it's like, well, I'll go and look at the pictures that they put up and the trophy case, and there will probably be something in the trophy case that is significant to later plot development.
You don't have all the answers, but you have a lot of interesting questions.
Right. And well, I don't have any of the answers because, like I said, I did not do the homework. But it's interesting to sort of think about how this would spin out.
Well, to go back to what Jim was starting to say before I cut him off, then our next month we'd be talking about current culture, right? So if we're talking about history here, maybe by next month Caroline will have something for us that maybe ties together whatever history she's figured out and the current culture that that we're going to talk about next time, right? Is it just current culture and the rules for things like magic and technology? Is that right, Kelly?
Yeah, I think also basically we want to talk about sort of like what happens in your story, not the plot so much as like, because when we've all talked about these revolutions that are happening in the stories and things. Well, I guess you and I, Dave, have. And so that, I guess that piece of it, like, right now we've sort of built our world up until the moment that our stories have started. How does what happens in our story affect the culture and the history? Well, not the history. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, I think to use Jim's as an example, you know, he's told us this great backstory of, you know, what would happen, but I'm still waiting to see the characters, like, what's day one of his story? Like, where do we start with the character who works in an office or is a revolutionary, or what is he? Who is he? Who is she? What are they doing in this world? And so I think, you know, that may be a good starting point for, you know, to talk about where the current culture is, where people fit into the worlds that we've been building, right? Or am I going?
Yes.
I was doubting myself there.
I affirm you.
That silence is terrifying, man.
It is.
Stop talking, and
you have no idea how many times I've gotten up and done a tap dance before realizing no one can see me.
And there we have the silence again.
So I think that's – are we good? Do we want to say anything more on these topics, or do we want to keep rolling?
I think we just want to say that people can continue to send us stuff if they want to send us their homework, because that was really cool to see. Definitely was perfect for this show to talk about Chris's history that goes all the way back to the beginning. Next month we'll talk about the current culture, and so maybe we just now can do we want to talk about what we're working on? I mean, we're all working on this stuff. Anybody have anything else that they want to plug?
I'm mostly working on this. The more I think about what a great title Killing Big Bird is, the more I think I should actually do something with this.
Yeah, I think you have to, man.
Well, indeed. You know, wait, that guy's still alive, right?
Yes, Carol Spinney is still alive. He is 147 years old, but he is still alive and is still doing Big Bird, yes.
It would just be unfortunate, you know, to sort
right.
of,
you know. If it came out that year, yes.
You would have you would want to at least, like, check on his health before.
Yes,
right. And don't subtitle it disagree. A manual or anything like that. Right.
A how-to guide. Modern...
You would be, like, boycotted and firebombed, you know.
Although I will say, for his age, it is amazing that he is still doing that. Especially really if you impressed. Know how complicated it is to work that thing. It is amazing that he, like... When I am 80 years old, I will be nowhere near holding my hand above my head for 10 hours a day. But anyway.
Well, I was losing everybody's sound. Sorry.
Yeah, it kind of blinked out there for a minute. We will call this technical difficulties. Okay, and resume.
I am, in addition to my deceptionist duties, at which I am slacking, with fantasticfangirls.org, we're getting close to a relaunch of that site. We've added several new staff writers, including Ali Coluccio, who has worked with iFanboy, is writing for us, and a few other folks. So I would encourage, you know, taking a look over there.
Yay.
And that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Kelly, anything?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. And Jim, anything you want to plug? You regularly write at ifanboy.com?
I do write a weekly column at ifanboy.com along with occasional news stories, although those news stories have recently gotten very occasional indeed. But every Monday afternoon at roughly 12 o'clock at ifanboy.com, I'm all yours. If you like comic books, you can listen to me or look at me opining about them half-cocked.
Yes, so. And Jim has been generating some nice hate mail from readers, I feel like, lately.
Well, it's gotten better.
It has. All right. And I am not on any show that has fan in the title. But you can catch me on the Fuzzy Typewriter show with Paul Montgomery. We just did a show on Jaws. The Blu-ray just
came
out.
Which was great, by the way.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Anyone who has not listened to it, Paul and Dave have a co-host named Josh Flanagan, also of iFanboy.com fame, who is also the world's biggest Jaws fan.
Yes.
And their analysis of that movie is funny and insightful and true, and also calls to mind the fact that I, too, leap every time that disembodied head floats in the water.
Yes.
Even though I've seen that movie 10 times, it always catches me by surprise. I don't know why.
Dave, my question is, are you going to do a different show for each movie in the Jaws franchise, including Jaws The Revenge, in which I believe Jaws stalks the family?
Yes. I bring that up. No,
I have not seen any of the Jaws sequels.
I started to mention that, and I think Josh Flanagan reached through my snowball microphone and hushed me quietly.
So there is only one Jaws.
Yes.
He is so upset that those movies exist.
Yes, exactly.
For people who are interested, Jaws 4 will be the next topic on the podcast at earwolf.com called How Did This Get Made?
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Nice. I love it.
Comedian Paul Scheer and company. Yes. So,
I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. That's not why you called. Go ahead.
We had our Jaws podcast. More recently, we had comics artist Scotty Young on, and we talked about the film Paranorman, which I wouldn't have expected to be totally my thing, but it kind of blew me away. It has this real 80s movie mentality. So if you like Monster Squad and the Goonies, or you grew up with that stuff, you kind of owe it to yourself to check that one out. Or just give the show a listen. Scotty is very enthusiastic about the movie, just a great guy to talk to. So that's
did
a lot
he
of fun.
Work on it, or he's just
he did not. He's just a fan, and he's got this cool. great story where he was a very vocal fan, and he actually got shipped this ultimate swag, I would call it. They shipped out like 49 of these crates to people like Neil Gaiman and Kevin Smith and different actors and actresses and stuff. And in the crate is like grave dirt, and you dig it up with a tiny shovel that they include. And then there's a coffin inside, and it's like a scale model of one of the zombies.
It's really awesome. I've seen a few people post their discovery pictures.
And yeah.
It's really cool.
He tells the whole story on the podcast. So you can check out Fuzzy Typewriter. And then I have a comic book out, the second issue of Sparrow and Crow. I've talked about it on this show a bunch of times, but the second issue should be out in a few weeks, in September, so mid to late September. Then we have a Halloween special that we're ramping up that's going to be digital only, so you can get it on Comixology, and that should be in October. And we've got, I think I said last time, 4 different short stories in there. And I'm actually really happy with I wrote an 8-page little story, and I'm very happy with the way the script came out, so I'm really excited about that one.
I have read that one, and number one anyway, Sparrow and Crow number one, and I know a thing or two about a thing or two, and you should all buy it, even if you don't care about comics or are illiterate, because it is great.
Thank you.
A+.
Yes, it is in digital now. That's right. I remember.
Yes, that's right.
And it's cheap. It's $1.99 for the first issue on Comixology, so you can go there and get it digitally if you like to read your comics that way.
If you can read, you love it. If you can't,
pictures
tell you the whole tale. It's yes. fine.
That should right. be the pull quote.
That yes. Is, yes.
Put that on the back of your graphic novel.
Pictures are also an option.
That's right.
All right. So should we talk about all the closing stuff, you know, that we do so
well? I can tell you this. If you want to keep up with us, our website is thedeceptionist.org. If you don't like looking at websites, our Twitter feed is @deceptionists, no the on that one. If you like email, you can email us at contact@thedeceptionist.org, and that is about the long and the short of it, right?
We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/TheDeceptionists.
Yes.
Yes. But our IT/social media team is the biggest slacker on the face of the planet.
That person is a social media warrior, ninja, rock star.
True.
Everything is well.
My defense is, you know, mechanics have crap cars because they sit around and mess with other people's cars all day. But I'm hoping to up our game soon.
You get home after your day on the internet, and you never want to spend another second on the internet as long as you live.
And yet she's here with us on Skype.
Exactly. I don't want to think about outreach and engagement and shit.
All right. How about personal Twitter handles so people can follow us on Twitter? I'm at Diacampo, DACCAMPO.
I am at Jimsky.
What's going next? Everyone else is Caroline. Dead. Caroline is just asleep. Caroline is at Mad Marvel Girl.
And I'm Kelly. I'm at Annaluna, A-N-N-A-L-U-N-A.
So in addition to following us on Twitter as a deceptionist, you can join in because we often have little conversations that break out on Twitter, and it's usually a lot of fun stuff. So I would recommend following all of us. I follow these three, and, you know, they're pretty entertaining. okay, so I think that's it. I think we wrapped up our show. So we'll be back in later in September. And
January.
We'll be back in January. you know, we're trying to keep a monthly schedule. This one's going to come out a little bit late. It might border on September, but we'll try to get the next one out in late September and keep that monthly schedule going. And, well, I think that's about it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Until next time, I am Jim.
And I'm Dave.
Caroline.
And Kelly.
Hey, we did it!
Hooray!
Without a script. Look at that. Thanks, folks. See you next time.
Jim, I don't know if we ever actually explained that you fell asleep on the last podcast.
It's like this nice inside joke.
I couldn't say either way. I was so humiliated by doing it that I never listened to the last episode.
What am I? Maybe there's a world that I'm still to find. Maybe there's a world that I'm still to